WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Brian Steidel, was a witness to crimes against humanity in Sudan. He's a 28-year-old former Marine captain who worked as an operational advisor to the African Union monitoring team in Darfur from last September to early February. He traveled with the team as they investigated violations of the ceasefire in Darfur. He first went to Sudan working with a private contractor hired by the U.S. State Department to monitor the ceasefire between the government in Khartoum and the rebels in the south, who had been in a civil war for over 20 years. That same private contractor later offered Steidel the position to work with the African Union monitoring team in Darfur. He left Darfur after several months, frustrated by the African Union's lack of resources and its narrow mandate, which was to report on crimes but not to intervene. Steidel decided he would be more effective describing what he witnessed to American legislators and to the American people. I asked him to describe one of the times he arrived with the monitoring team at a Darfur village during a massacre. Tell us about one of the times you arrived while a massacre was in progress.
I would have to say that the village of Labado, it was a village of 20,000 people. And the attack had happened the previous night and through into the morning. And we'd arrived in the morning, and I was standing there at the edge of the village with a Sudanese general who was in charge of the government forces and the Janjaweed forces that were there. We estimated there were maybe 4,500 total between the government and the Janjaweed. And we were standing at the edge of this village of 20,000, and it was burning in front of us. And there were, the Janjaweed were coming in from left to right and loading up their pack animals, horses, camels, donkeys, and then heading back out to the left and stacking it in huge piles and dividing up all of the loot. The village was being burnt in front of us. There were shots being fired in front of us. We could not see who they were shooting at because the village is so large and we were only on one side of it. But we wanted to enter to one, see what was going on, to get firsthand evidence. Two, to see if there were any injured people in the village that we could try to get out and get back to medical help. But we were unable to go in. The general had told us that he couldn't guarantee our safety if we had gone into the village, and that if we'd gone in the village, that most likely we would have been shot.
You mean he was telling you that if you went in, his men would kill you?
He didn't state it as directly as that, but yes, that's what we believed. Maybe not his men directly, but the Janjaweed forces that were in there. We don't differentiate between the government and the Janjaweed. It was, the Janjaweed and the government are the same. It's just having two different units. An army group that has, one group of regular army soldiers and one group of special forces soldiers, and they'd be working together on a certain operation. We're there unarmed, and he says something like that, and there's nothing that we can do. We say, okay, well, we're not going to go in there. We tried to talk to him, and I specifically asked him. I said, what's your mission? He said, well, my mission is to protect the civilians and to open up this road so the commercial traffic can travel on it. And I said, well, I don't understand then. These guys, surely they're yours, so why don't you stop them? He said, well, they're not my guys. Those aren't my guys. I said, that guy is. Surely that guy is. He's in military uniform. And he says, no, he's not mine. He's not mine. And a vehicle pulls out of the compound behind us, and it drives around to the left and it enters the village. And I said, surely these soldiers are yours. He said, yes, those are mine. They're going to fetch water. The vehicle stops 75 meters in front of us. Soldiers dismount. They go into a hut. They loot the hut. They burn the hut. And they continue. I said, those are your soldiers. Why don't you stop them? He said, oh, they're not my soldiers. So that is, they continuously change the story as things go on.
Had you ever encountered that kind of arrogance of power before, where someone could just tell you this complete bold-faced lie, and everything you're witnessing proves it's a lie, but he's got the power and he can keep lying and there's nothing you can do about it? Was this your first time experiencing something like that?
No. Every single time that we interviewed one of the government commanders, the government of Sudan commanders, that's the way it was. They would tell us that the bullets that they were firing had caught the huts on fire, and that's why it had burned, although that the grass around the compound and around the hut were burned, but the grass in the middle of the road was not burned. And they would tell us that it transferred from one to the other. Just a basic lie. They would tell us that the helicopter gunships had escorted them there, and they hadn't fired on the village. And a lot of times we couldn't find any evidence of shrapnel in the village. We could not find it. We had no idea, because there was a lot of evidence from talking to the people, from us seeing them leave the airport at a certain time, to us seeing wounds that, you know, would only come from helicopter gunships, and we couldn't find evidence. They would collect a lot of the shrapnel themselves. We would go to the IDPs, the internally displaced persons, the refugees in the camps, and ask them if they have evidence of the gunships being used, and they would bring out piles and piles of shrapnel, you know, a meter long by a meter wide, sitting 6 to 12 inches tall, just shrapnel. And they would, oh, that's not from us, that's not ours, I don't know where they got this from. Just bold-faced lies.
There were times when you were able to get physically deeper into the conflict and see what was happening, times when there wasn't a general who was preventing you from going in. Tell us what you were able to see during one of those times and what you think being able to write a report may have accomplished. Start with telling us what you saw.
When we would enter these villages, we would see everything from, you know, the villages being completely burnt down of this village, 20,000, several other. I don't need, you know, it's too hard to try to figure out how many villages I saw burnt down in the 6 months I was there. We would see scores of people who had been killed. We would conduct interviews with women who had been gang raped. Women who had been raped inside an IDP camp that's supposed to be protected by the government, where the Janjaweed would enter the IDP camp and rape the women. We would go into villages where people had been locked in their huts before the huts were set on fire. We would see evidence of torture, people who had their ears cut off, their eyes plucked out, men who had been castrated and left to bleed to death, infants who had been shot by government forces. Those are the things that we would see nearly every day.
So you'd see this and write a report. Who was the report for?
The report was for the African Union.
Now, did the government have any input, the government of Sudan have any input into the reports?
They would sometimes not agree with the conclusions and the recommendations that the African Union team leader would make. And they had an opportunity. A lot of times they wouldn't want to sign the reports. And
Were they supposed to sign the report?
Yes, they're supposed to sign the reports. And what we finally were able to do is we were able to have them sign the report but say that they want to write an addendum to the report. And they could write the addendum on why they didn't agree with the recommendations or agree with the conclusion. We would attach that to the report and then send it up. For example, you know, the report on the village of Marla, where we couldn't find any impacts from the rockets of the gunship, but we found lots of shrapnel. We knew the helicopters were flying over there because a lot of the aid organizations in the UN were reporting that they were flying over that area that day and firing. We saw evidence of the wounds on the people, but the government of Sudan said because there weren't any impacts, then the gunships obviously didn't fire. So that's what they would say.
There weren't any impacts?
We did not find the impacts from the actual rockets that hit the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you didn't, because they used a different type of rocket. Instead of a destroying the hut, or destroying a vehicle, the high explosive rocket, they would use an anti-personnel rocket. Each helicopter gunship carries 4 rocket pods, and each rocket pod about 20 rockets. And each of those rockets carry about 500, several hundred at least, of these flechettes, which is basically a 2-inch nail with a little fin on the back, like a dart. And it would fire out of the rocket, and the nose cone would expel, and all these darts would come out like a shotgun round. And they use those a lot of the times. And they would not leave an impact on the ground. They would just cause mass casualties in the civilian population.
When you interviewed the government and the Janjaweed militiamen about the destruction of villages and the massacres of people, if there were times when they didn't deny any responsibility at all, what did they tell you about their motivation?
They would be very, very blunt with us. There was one time in the village of Adwa when we were talking to a large group of the Janjaweed, and they said that some of their camels had been stolen. and that they had tracked them down to this village, the Adwa, and that's why they had attacked it, burned half of it down, killed scores of people, and that they had now tracked them to these other villages, and they named them for us. They named, the next four villages in a line, and they said that we are going to go to those villages. If we don't get our camels back, we're going to go to those villages. We're going to kill all the people. We're going to burn the village down. We're going to rape all the women, and we're going to steal everything that we can. They told us bluntly, right to our faces, that's what they're going to do. And they did it. They went to the next two villages. The African Union was able to stop the last attack on the final village of the four that they had named. But they went to those next two villages, one of which, the village of Hamada. There were no rebel forces in the village. They surrounded the village, the Janjaweed militia, backed by a reserve police force from the government of Sudan. And they also had helicopter gunships and Antonovs flying over above. They surrounded the entire village with the intent of killing everybody. They killed 107 women and children that day.
Was there a typical pattern that the Janjaweed and the government forces used when they decided to destroy a village?
The majority of the time, an Antonov aircraft would go in, circle over high above. The helicopter gunships would normally come in after that, strafe the village, flying low, firing their weapons at anything that moved. And shortly behind that would follow the government forces and the Janjaweed. And the Janjaweed sometimes were in vehicles of the government, and most of the time they were on their horses and their camels. When they do the attack on the village, the ones that were on camels would dismount, because a camel is not as agile as a horse. So they would dismount their camels, leave them on the outskirts of the town, and the men on horses and the other people on foot would then enter the village with the government forces, killing everybody and attempting to burn everything down. One thing I did leave out is that before any of that happens, we always knew that there was an attack ongoing, because the cell phones would go down. The government of Sudan has control over the cell phones, and before the helicopters fly, before the Antonov takes off, they would shut the cell phone systems down so that there would be no warning from the people that saw the helicopters to the village that was going to be attacked. And we would always try to figure out when that happened, when the cell phones went down, one, how long it was going to be before the helicopters took off, and two, which way they were going, so we could try to get there before them, so we could try to attempt to stop the attack, or to get there as the attack's ongoing so we could document what was happening.
Did you have a sense at all how much pure sadism was entering into this, as opposed to some sense of revenge that they felt that they could use to justify their actions?
I don't really know about that. I mean, you'd look at these people and you would swear you were looking in the devil's eyes. They have no remorse for what they do. It's pretty chilling to look at these people and say, they can sit here and they can joke with me, and they can sit across the ground as we're sitting on the ground talking to each other, yet they just killed a 2-year-old baby by smashing its head in, and not feel anything by it. It's pretty chilling.
My guest is Brian Steidel. He was an advisor to the African Union monitoring team in Darfur. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Steidel, and he's a former Marine captain who worked as an advisor for the African Union monitoring team in Darfur. And since returning from Darfur, he's been speaking to members of Congress. He even spoke to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Were there times when you stepped out of your role as monitor and did something that you felt could help in some way?
Yes, we did a number of things, the African Union, the monitors on the ground, to attempt to help the people. We would conduct patrols up a road and notify the aid organizations, the UN, to pass the word that we are leaving at this time to go to this place, and that anybody who wants to go, can follow on with us. We weren't specifically, in our mandate, it doesn't specifically say escorting aid convoys, yet we would put one of our vehicles at the front and one of our vehicles at the end, and they would sit in the middle and we would go up the road. That wasn't specifically in our mandate. We would do that to help them out. One instance specifically was the attack on Adwa. I didn't go to the site. My team did not. But the Janjaweed were on one side of the village attacking and burning, and the African Union teams were on the other and there were a lot of people that were both walking and lying wounded. And in our mandate, we're not allowed to carry civilians in our helicopters, people not of the African Union. But, you know, we felt it necessary at the time to take these wounded people and get them to medical care. So we loaded up the helicopters with the wounded personnel and did a number of trips back to our camp, where we turned our dining facilities into a triage ward. We had members from the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross. We had members of MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières. We had our medic. In addition to that, our protection force that was with us, the Rwandese at the time, had a medic with them. And also one of our monitors was a former paramedic before he came out, and he was also doing treating. So we pulled everybody we possibly could together to do triage in our dining facility to try to help, you know, save as many people as we could.
Now, you mentioned helping aid convoys by putting one vehicle from the African Union in front of the convoy and another in the rear. But as a monitoring team, you weren't allowed to carry weapons, right?
We were not able to carry weapons. We did have a protection force with us, and their job was to protect our camp and to protect us. So, of course, if we were under attack, if our vehicles were under attack, then they would have been able to respond.
Did you feel like being part of a monitoring team from the African Union made you safer or made you a target?
You know, on both sides. It made us safer and it made us, you know, more of a target. Safer because, you know, from a government standpoint, Governor Sudan's standpoint and the rebel standpoint, they knew that the eyes of the world were on us and what we were doing, and that there was a lot of countries that were involved in the AU's mission there, and if they had attacked us or done something to us, then they would have, you know, been seen as the bad guys from the entire world. Now, on the other side, the Janjaweed militia, of course, are not party to the ceasefire agreement, and the government considers them not theirs. So they would, on a number of times, take shots at us when we would get too close. They didn't want to talk to us. They'd shoot at us to warn us off. And also on that side, I would have to say that the villagers, again, are not party to the ceasefire. Many of them are armed, and sometimes they would become frustrated with the African Union. They wouldn't understand what our mandate was, wouldn't understand what our limitations were. There was one incident where the village I just spoke of, Labado, had been attacked, and the next village online was Mahajuria, and my team had showed up there, and the people of the village wanted us to go find 85 individuals from the village of Labado who apparently had been taken by the government of Sudan and the Arab militia to some wadi or a riverbed nearby. And some had been executed, and the others apparently were lying under the trees. And we couldn't get any more information from them except that it was in a nearby wadi. This is, you know, a vast, vast land, and we needed to know at least a cardinal direction. They said north, and we said, okay, how far? They couldn't give us the information. We said, well, we're going to go and we're going to look for them. We're going to go circle above, and they said, no. You're going to stay here as insurance, and we're going to take your helicopter, and we're going to go get our people and bring them back here. And so it took a few minutes, probably 15 minutes, for us to talk to the villagers, talk to the rebels that were there, separate from the villagers, and convince them, the rebel groups, the SLA and the GEM, to convince the villagers that we needed to go to do our mission.
How frustrating was that to be there to help them, and then they want to almost hold you hostage and take your helicopter?
Well, it was very frustrating, but you have to look at the situation from their eyes. You have to see that village after village after village has been attacked. These people have been driven from their homes. They've been in an IDP camp and then driven out of an IDP camp and then been in another IDP camp and then been driven out of that one. And they're extremely frustrated. And up until, you know, very recently, I would say the end of January, the African Union has been unable to stop the fighting. They have been unable to protect the civilians. The rebels have been unable to protect the civilians because they are extremely, they're outnumbered, and they don't have the firepower to defend the government attacks.
Now, since returning from Darfur, you've met with various senators, including Senator Brownback, and you've met with Condoleezza Rice. What is your ambition in speaking with them?
Nobody has seen a government of Sudan helicopter attacking a village and been able to come back and talk about it. I have. Nobody's seen, you know, these villages being burnt down in front of their eyes and seeing government of Sudan soldiers looting, you know, shooting the locks off of shops, going in, taking stuff out and coming, you know, and stealing stuff out of a store. Well, I have. And that's what I hope to do is to give them a first-hand account of what is happening on the ground, not second-hand, third-hand stories, but this is what I have seen. Here are my pictures. You know, look at this. These are the atrocities that are happening on the ground. Now, we need to try to make this more of a priority. I think that we need to take the next step and try to put more pressure on the UN and the rest of the countries in the world to do what's right.
Do you think you will ever go back to Darfur?
No, I do not believe I'll ever be able to get a visa to go to Sudan, which, you know, I had a lot of really good friends there. There's some very good people in Sudan, and I would like to see them again, but I don't believe I'll ever be able to go back there. And if I did get a visa to go to Sudan, I don't believe that it would be safe for me to return to Sudan at this point.
Well, Brian Steidel, good luck to you, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Brian Steidel is a former Marine captain who worked with the African Union monitoring team in Darfur from last September to February. More on Sudan in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.